Good day, everyone, and welcome to the Cigna Drug and Alcohol Education Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, it is my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ann Sweeney-Levan. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Nicole, and good day. Thank you for calling into Cigna's Drug and Alcohol Awareness Series. My name is Ann Sweeney-Levan, and I'm a lead clinician for the outpatient team at Cigna. Due to the format of this call, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, you'll be transferred into a brief five-question survey in which we're requesting your feedback regarding your experience in today's seminar. And then after the survey, you'll be able to ask questions on today's seminar. There is a PowerPoint available for the seminar today. It's online at www.cignabehavioral.com. When you get to the website, on the left-hand side, if you click on Visit Our Education and Resource page, and then click on Drug and Alcohol Awareness, then click on Drug and Alcohol Awareness, a Cigna Education Series, and you'll be able to see the handouts for today. And please note that not all policies cover today's topic. For more specific information, if your policy covers topics discussed in today's seminar, please contact the outpatient team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. And then today I have the pleasure of introducing Sarah Lewis-Fernandez. Sarah is the Assistant Program Director at Dynamic Youth Community, Inc., and an adolescent outpatient program located in Brooklyn, New York. And most recently, Sarah was part of a presentation panel for a discussion on a therapeutic community model of treatment at the 13th Annual ASAP Conference. And joining Sarah today is Sharon Smith. Sharon's a member of the Parents Advisory Board for the Partnership for Drugfree.org. She is also the founder and president of Moms Tell, a parent advocacy group founded in 2001 to support parents with children suffering from disease of addiction. So with that, I'll go ahead and pass it on to Sarah and Sharon.
Hi, thank you so much, Ann. Hello, everyone. Today I'm going to talk about the diagnosis and treatment of the joint disorders of substance abuse addiction and mental illness, here known as the co-occurring disorder. I'll be providing information from the professional's perspective, and as was just said, joining me will be Sharon Smith-Lagore, who will be sharing her experience from the viewpoint as a parent. As was said, the PowerPoint is available, so please use it and jot down any questions that you have that we can listen to at the end. Diagnosing and treating a co-occurring disorder is a process. We definitely want to highlight that to accurately assess this problem and place someone in the right treatment. Every person is to be seen individually, but we will try to answer and give as much information as we can here in a general way so that it can help guide. Our intention is to help guide and inform the professional and to empower parents and loved ones that are working with this disorder. I want to talk about that there is disagreement in the field about diagnosis, treatment, and medication. This forum is meant to be an open discussion to give our experience and knowledge to help answer some of that confusion, especially because this is a very diverse population, from very mild to severe on both sides of the spectrum, from temporary to permanent. And to make the situation even more complicated, the co-occurring disorders affect each other and interact with each other. When a mental health problem goes untreated, a substance abuse problem usually gets worse as well. And when alcohol or drug abuse increases, mental health problems usually get worse too. Although positively, when one is treated, the other disorder also tends to improve. To give some statistics and just some background of this disorder, various studies have given between 40 and 70% of people in treatment meet the requirements for both of the disorders. To break that down even further, 37% of alcohol abusers and 53% of drug abusers have at least one serious mental illness. Of all people diagnosed as mentally ill, 29% abuse either alcohol or drugs. I also want to say that it's just been found that if one begins with a mental health diagnosis, they have found that it makes them more vulnerable to a substance use disorder problem. There are gender differences when it comes to this disorder. Women are diagnosed with more mental illness, and men receive the diagnosis of conduct disorder more than women do. At this point, that's just some basics of the topic that we're going to cover today. Just to give you a little bit of the outline, we're going to talk about first assessment and the diagnosing of the disorder, and then we're going to go into the treatments separately, and then we're going to give some resources at the end. But before we go into that, I'm going to turn it over to Sharon so you can share some of the background of your story. She has extensive personal experience in this area.
Thanks, Sharon. Hello, everyone. And I just want to take a few minutes just to share a little bit and show you a reality perspective, more or less, from a parent and a family point of view, and what my own experience and my children's experience has been with not only substance abuse, but unfortunately delving into the world of co-occurring, which has just been extremely traumatic for my family. So for me to try to figure out how to put about 18 years of my life with my children's addictions, co-occurring disorders into a few minutes is difficult, but I'm going to try. And one of the first things I, you know, want to mention is genetics. And that's a word I'd never even factored in as I was learning about addiction, the disease of addiction, and mental illness. I come from a long line of alcoholics, and on my children's father's side, there is mental illness. You know, as a matter of fact, the very first prayer I ever learned as a little girl was the Serenity Prayer, which I might add I've used numerous times throughout my life dealing with my family's addictions, and it's sitting right here above my desk. You know, I made the choice as a child never to use drugs and alcohol because of my lived experience as a child of an alcoholic. And I thought, as an adult, that telling my children about drugs and alcohol and the effect that it had within our family, what I went through as a child, what my mom went through living with my dad in his alcoholism, and I thought that alone would be enough protective factors. You know, but I was really wrong. I was uneducated about addiction, about mental illness. And, you know, I just did not know what I did not know about mental health and substance abuse. And with addiction, I truly just thought, you know, you can just quit. I remember telling my daughter many times, if you love me enough, you could quit. My daughter's addiction became the first to surface. And after 4.5 years battling her addictions, she unfortunately lost her life to an overdose of heroin. You know, the trauma for each member of my family surrounding the years before and after her death took their toll. As one by one, unfortunately, my boys turned to drugs and alcohol to cope, with all their feelings, to cope with all their emotions. And I can't possibly share with you in this amount of time all the incredible, painful experiences we faced as a family. And I can't do it in this short time span, but I can tell you that I was lost as a parent. I didn't know where to go, who to ask. I didn't know what to ask. I didn't even know who to trust. And I felt all alone in this battle to save my children's lives. One by one, they began displaying all too familiar signs and symptoms. And some days, I just laid in my bed and cried because I didn't know what to do next. I didn't know who to call. I didn't know where to go for help. My daughter had been in 11 different facilities. We had her in 11 different facilities trying to get help. But a few days stay, or even a few weeks here or there, didn't solve the problems. And once I heard about recovery, a recovery plan, you know, that was never even mentioned to us. It was take her home, she's well. So I didn't even know that she needed a recovery plan or what that entailed or what I could do to help. I could go on and on about my boys and their lifelong struggle, but I really want to focus on my youngest because his story is about my introduction into the world of co-occurring disorders. When his sister died, my youngest showed no emotion whatsoever when he received the news. He just said, "Well, Mom, can I go ride my bike?" You know, I thought that was really a strange reaction, and it concerned me but I was so overwhelmed with the loss of my daughter. And 1 month later, the suicide attempt of my one son, because he felt so guilty that it should have been him that saved his sister. I didn't catch the signs. I didn't catch symptoms. I didn't see anything. Even though to some people, these signs and symptoms might have been quite evident, I was dealing with my own grief and pain. So one thing I want to add, if there's any providers listening here or people who deal with parents in this situation, please tell them to not only focus on the adolescent with the problem, but also on your other children, the siblings. This is a traumatic on all the entire family. And for Sean, boy, what I learned is that no emotion outside could never prepare me for the rage of emotions inside that was to come. I missed the early signs of mental illness, which all progressed slowly. And in trying to get the proper help, we just ran out of time. He had been diagnosed with ADHD as an adolescent and started on meds for that. But he still struggled. We still had trouble finding a counselor or someone that could really take an interest in Sean and really help at the time. And by the time he became 18, you know, there went our control. We no longer had any control on his health care. He had no insurance. And so he sought other means to treat himself. And as with co-occurring disorder, naturally, he picked his own drug of choice, and that drug was DXM or cough syrup. And he would drink 3, 4, 5 bottles of that at a time. You know, he began displaying bizarre behaviors. I mean, bizarre. Violence, hallucination, paranoia. I just felt like there was a stranger that I was facing. It was not my gentle, loving son. He was someone I couldn't recognize, someone I didn't know, and someone I was afraid of, which I had never been when it comes to my children. You know, hard choices had to be made in the course of all of this because I tried to seek help and I couldn't find it. So I had to have him arrested in order to save his life. And I know there's controversy even on that issue, but I had no choice. I had to protect my son and I had to protect those who would come in contact with him because of his untreated illnesses. I have no time to tell you what happened once they put him in a 5-point restraints and isolation for 24 hours and what that did to his mind. And after 3 rounds of incarcerations, about 6 months each, and going in and coming out, being given a couple pills and go find a psychiatrist and that's that. And when he came out, he would be treated and he would be, you know, almost like his old self. But then again, he came out in the mode of, I don't need any crutches, I'm well now. And so medication, a psychiatrist, healthcare, none of that was a choice for him. And when things spun out of control again, then he went right back to his drugs of choice. You know, one time we finally found a psychiatrist who was trying to help. And Sean was diagnosed bipolar, schizophrenic, borderline personality disorder, and a few others that I lost track of. But put my son on meds, and for a while he thought he was cured, and there we go again. He stopped. So I've lost track of how many hospital visits we've had over the years. And when going, they always ask, is it a substance abuse problem or is it a mental health problem? But I'd get so angry because it's not the chicken or the egg problem, because it's one brain with 2 problems. You can't separate the brain from the body. You know, so why try separating the treatments? Treat them together. It's been 14 years since my daughter's death, and for 14 years I've struggled with my son's co-occurring disorders, hospitalizations, arrest, visits to psychiatric wards, visits to prisons regularly, And with everything I learned, I'm still helpless to help. I could tell you story after story about the intense fear and pain of his illness and what it's caused our family, let alone the torture in his own mind that he's had to face alone. I can tell you about the glimpses of hope I see when he's been on his meds, like he should, when he's gotten the help. I could also share the pain felt as a mother who cannot help her son. And right now, my son's drug of choice is the K2 spice. I just got a call a few minutes ago, and there's another major crisis going on with Sean. And, you know, my hope is that he'll get arrested so everyone will be safe, and maybe this time he'll get what he needs, the help that he needs. But as his mom, I have to accept his mental illness and the reality that I cannot fix him. He's been hospitalized 4 times since the holidays and arrested a couple. And as of yet, no one, even though I've begged, is willing to keep my son in long term and get him the proper treatment. And, you know, sorry if I offend anybody, but if I hear the word HIPAA, it's the reason I can't tell or learn or share anything. One more time, I think I'll scream. Maybe, just maybe, if he had had the proper diagnosis in the beginning and the proper treatment as an adolescent for both his mental illness and substance abuse, I would not be here telling you this today. But I also want to tell you I'm not alone. There are similar stories like this happening across America, and the need for co-occurring disorder diagnosis and treatment is crucial. Our children, our families are suffering, and we need help, and we need hope. Sarah?
Yes.
I'm going to turn it back to you.
Sharon, thank you so much. I can't thank you enough for sharing that very, you know, personal and touching story about what you've gone through and what you're going through. You make it very real and, you know, definitely give the picture of how serious this is and how difficult it is to go through this process from the person that's feeling it and their family members. So thank you so much for providing that insight for all of us. I want to move into, we're going to talk about some basics about diagnosing. We're going to talk about first some signs of substance abuse. I didn't want to completely bore our lunchtime listeners with the criterion in the DSM-4, but it is an excellent resource to use if you're a professional and you need to do a diagnosis for either substance abuse or mental health diagnosis. But here I want to talk about just some signs and symptoms that you might be seeing or feeling if you do have a substance abuse disorder. So first, it's that feeling that you have to use the drug regularly. This can be daily or even several times a day, and making sure that you have your supply. Failing in your attempts to stop using the drug, spending money on the drug even though you can't afford it. Doing things to obtain the drug that you wouldn't normally do, such as stealing. Driving or doing other risky behaviors or activities that you wouldn't do if you were not under the influence of the drug. Feeling that you need your drug or alcohol to deal with your problems. Now, very specifically, I wanted to add some things for parents who might be seeing some signs in their adolescents. So possible indications that your teenager is using drugs. First is problems at school, frequently missing classes or missing school entirely, a sudden disinterest in school or school activities, and a drop in grades. Physical health issues that you might see, lack of energy, motivation, even unexplained injuries can signal a problem. Neglected appearance. Teenagers are usually concerned about how they look to others. So a sudden lack of interest in clothing, grooming, or looks may be a warning sign of drug use. Changes in the behavior. Teenagers do enjoy privacy, but exaggerated efforts to bar family members from entering their rooms or knowing where they go with their friends. Drastic changes in behavior in their relationships with family and friends may be linked to drug use. Changes in their groups of friends. Loss of friends. These are all signals. Spending money. Sudden request for money without a reasonable explanation for its use may be a sign. You may also discover money stolen from previously safe places at home, and items may disappear from your home because they're being sold to support a drug habit. Also, due to our prescription drug epidemic that's happening across the country, it's important to be aware of any missing medications that, you know, are in your home or in your medicine cabinet, it's important to keep an eye on those because that's where some drug abuse habits are beginning, are right in our homes. So now some common mental illnesses that we see when we see someone with substance abuse disorders. The very first one under the access one are the mood disorders, so that's the variety of depression and bipolar disorders that you might see. Anxiety and psychotic disorders are very frequent. Eating disorders in young women are very common. Adolescents in general, the most common access 1 disorders we're going to see are disruptive behavior disorders, and that includes ADHD, conduct, and oppositional defiant disorders. And these are actually good examples of the disagreement in the field over the diagnosis of these disorders. Conduct disorder and oppositional in particular, because many of their criteria for diagnosis can accurately, you know, can also be reflective of their substance abuse or even regular adolescent development when separating from parents or just becoming independent from authority. Access 2 diagnosis, the most frequent in this personality disorder category are the cluster B, which are antisocial, borderline, histrionic, and narcissistic. These personality characteristics are emotional, dramatic, and erratic in their behaviors and in interpersonal relationships. Very important when we're talking about assessing the person accurately for a co-occurring disorder is a proper and thorough detoxification. Signs of mental disorder can look like addiction, and addiction can mask mental illness. Drugs or alcohol can also be used as a self-medication, which, you know, Sharon did describe in her story. I think, Sharon, one of your questions was that if you, you know, where do you start at?
I know I had asked this of you before, Sarah, is where do you go? Because I know in my own case, when I've taken Sean to the hospital, what has happened, and you know, they say, is it mental health or isn't? And when they've diagnosed him as that, and I say, look up the diagnosis, and they say, well, he's using, so it's substance abuse. What do you do? Where do you go and where do you start? What questions do you ask?
Right. That's very important. Definitely the first thing that you want to do is what's the primary issue at the time. And as you've told, it could be very different things. If someone is in a withdrawal, a dangerous withdrawal from a substance, or they are overdosing, the first place you want to start at is the detox, substance abuse detox. If the person is at harm to themselves or others, the first place that you want to go is the mental health facility. But ideally, you know, you want to be at a facility who they're going to be evaluating for both, and they have the capability to at least provide some services for both of those issues. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's what's really important is to know that there is help out there that would address both issues, because in my experience in going to emergency rooms, it's just so difficult, you know, with trying to get somebody that can assess both. So trying to figure out, you know, where do you go in that case, and really what questions to ask, you know, treatment, intervention, of course, the action, you know, what do we need, how will it work, what's included, what's the evidence, and things like that that parents don't think of. I know if I was more well-armed with information regarding not only substance abuse but the mental health issues and how they work together and what I needed to do, you know, what would work best for my child, it would have made a difference.
Right, exactly. So I think knowing some signs that we talked about are some things that, you know that you're looking at, and to come in and be able to inform the practitioner, like, what you're seeing and why you're bringing them in, I think you're starting off on your best foot.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing I know we both wanted to talk about is denial, just to be aware and sensitive to the denial that surrounds both of these situations. It is very difficult for the person that's suffering with these to acknowledge and accept that they have a substance abuse disorder, and then on top of that, or in conjunction with a mental health disorder, both of them separately, are difficult to face and accept and carry possible social stigmas with them. And then when the person has to look at and accept they have both of these issues, I think that we have to be sensitive to how difficult that is, even in the beginning process when we're trying to assess and diagnose a person with a co-occurring disorder. And I know that also applies to families and loved ones who have to also face the same denial and don't want to see, maybe at least in the beginning of the process, that their loved one is facing these problems that can be very stigmatizing.
Yeah, Sarah, one thing I just would like to add to that in the denial aspect is that, you know, a lot of these behaviors that you see could be masked as what they call typical adolescent behavior, which is what I looked at it as.
Right.
And when I saw even more, you know, in your face symptoms, it wasn't denial that I just can't believe my child's doing this. It was a denial, you know, that I just can't believe this, you know, and what am I supposed to do? And God, please let it just be adolescent, you know, teenage behavior. And so at that point in time is when I needed, you know, some help. And how do I accept this as well, you know, and not stay in denial, but how do I accept it and figure out some proactive things that I can do to help my child.
Right.
And myself.
Right.
Because the families, the parents need help too.
Absolutely. And I think sometimes it is. I mean, sometimes when you're first initially seeing some of these things, it is hard to distinguish between regular adolescent behavior and the beginning or development of one or both of these problems. So it definitely is very tricky in the beginning, but I think it's important to say it's not going to hurt to come for an evaluation or to approach or contact a professional to have an evaluation done. It's not going to hurt, especially if you go to the right person who is going to be sensitive to and knowledgeable of all of these situations.
Yeah, and I think what's so hard, Sarah, is the fact that when you go
mm-hmm.
for an assessment or an evaluation, that you don't know what to ask for, and maybe you may just get a screening as opposed
right.
to an evaluation. And
right.
so what I've learned in the process is there's a full comprehensive evaluation. And why is that so important?
Yeah, definitely. I'm glad that you brought that up. I wanted to talk about that. You know, an assessment, I just want to say, is an ongoing process because, like we said, this is a process, and especially since they can mask each other, someone needs to be seeing someone on an ongoing basis. So definitely a full extended an assessment period, not just an assessment visit, an assessment period is really going to show and give the idea of an accurate diagnosis at whether you're looking at either or both of these situations. So you really need, it's like you said, it's not just a simple screening or meeting someone for 10 minutes and, you know, asking a series of questions. It's either a series of meetings or a full evaluation, because if you don't assess properly from the very beginning, the assessment is what guides the treatment services. So if you don't have the right diagnosis from the beginning, then the treatment won't be accurate. You're either going to miss something, you're going to overlook something, and at that point, when you're missing a critical element of the treatment, you can sabotage the recovery from either or even both.
And so that when you were asking about a comprehensive evaluation, the importance of making sure you don't get a full evaluation of, let's just say, the substance abuse or the mental health, but to ask for both.
Yes.
That's very important.
If you're unsure. Right.
And you just think you're seeing things.
Right. But you're coming in informed as well that you know, you have the things that you know that you've seen in your home. So to give that information, you know, to the practitioner is very important, because that's going to help the assessment process as well.
Right.
Okay. Anything else, Sharon, that you wanted to add or ask about when any other diagnosing? I think you wanted to share a little bit about the process of getting the right diagnosis for you.
Absolutely. It was very difficult getting a proper diagnosis, and that's why it's so important, you know, for us as parents to be educated and to learn, you know, what questions we should ask when we go in for this, because if someone just says, well, we can do a screening, not knowing the importance of full comprehensive evaluation, the importance of getting, you know, as you said, there's assessments that are periodic and continuing, and getting the proper treatment, you know, it's just extremely difficult, because you could be diagnosed as in my son's case, you know, ADHD, which would be a typical diagnosis for a child that, you know, is exhibiting behaviors. But there was never, I can tell you, there was a screening, but there was never a full assessment done or a comprehensive evaluation, because I didn't know. I thought, well, if they're screening him, that must be enough. And it truly wasn't enough. And so the proper diagnosis wasn't there. And that's why, you know, I keep pushing for early intervention and proper diagnosis and get on a treatment plan and get a recovery follow-up plan and educate parents on what it is they need to know, what questions do they need to ask that, you know, would give the opportunity to produce the best results for their children and for the family, what help they need to get for them. But that diagnosis initially and knowing what to ask and get those details is important, because by the time we had a diagnosis, you know, we were well into the early 20s, and by then, you know, we were at a loss at how we could help. Getting the diagnosis in adolescence, you still have time to help make those crucial choices for proper care.
Right. To summarize the diagnosis part of this talk, I just want to say that we've given signs of substance abuse disorder and the most common mental health disorders that we see in co-occurring. We talked about the importance of detoxification, and like we just finished talking about, the full extended assessment period for an accurate diagnosis. Now we really want to focus a little bit on the treatment of co-occurring disorders. I want to say that there are different options when it comes to treatment services based on the severity of the problem. There's a range, like we talked about, from detoxification to short-term residential, long-term residential, outpatient, intensive outpatient, community residences, sober living. There's a spectrum of treatment services out there for treating co-occurring disorders. It's important to know that one type of program can be modified if the second disorder is mild. So, for example, if someone comes in with a major issue of substance abuse disorder, they can offer medication in that program, or special groups can be given that are educational or process-driven in the mental health program. Also, though, if it's severe issue on both sides in the co-occurring disorder, major modifications are necessary for effective treatment. And ideally, a treatment program that treats co-occurring disorders specifically would be the most appropriate placement. The other thing I want to talk about is the importance of collaboration between professionals. And it's really a case management issue here, because in a lot of cases, it's not a treatment program that's treating both. It's two different treatment providers, either individual providers or programs that are treating one individual. So the collaboration between them, the calls, the follow-ups, to make sure that both you know, both people are on the same page and are working with that person, and that they're communicating on the, you know, the positive signs of recovery or even the negative signs of relapse or regression. It needs to be discussed between individuals.
You know, Sarah, as you're mentioning the importance of the collaboration, you know, do you have any advice on how to make this happen? I know I came across it was just so difficult, because it was like nobody was talking to each other, and if they did, and we could all work together, maybe things, you know, the outcome would have been improved, because we're all working for the same thing, especially when you come between mental health and substance abuse.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to, I mean, this is very important, but I don't want to give the impression that it's easy. It is very difficult,
very difficult.
Given the caseloads and everything that happens, but it is extremely important. I think as a family member and as an involved loved one, I think just to stay involved. Speak to everyone that's involved. If treated by separate people or agencies, make sure that you are in contact with both of them. And I think what's important is don't hold back any information or be afraid to tell them anything. Sometimes I think there's a a tendency to hold back some information for fear of how that would be handled or looked at. But you know your child best. You see more of them than, in most cases, than the professional would. So you really help giving pertinent information to help the treatment process. And one important thing is, as a parent or a loved one, trust your instincts again. I know that, you know, in dealing with these disorders, you know, our instincts as loved ones, we start to doubt them because of the manipulative and dishonesty that comes along with substance abuse. But begin to trust. It's true. It's true. We tend to start doubting ourselves because of the person that's in our life starts, you know, telling us that it's not true. But once they're in the recovery process, come back to trusting your instincts again, especially once you have that diagnosis and you know that you're dealing with someone that has these issues. So trust your instincts and then share that information with the people who are trying to help your loved one.
Excellent point, Sarah.
I also want to talk about medication and the management of medication and how that can complicate, interfere, or stunt treatment. I think common examples of these are, you mentioned ADHD before, adolescents being treated with the medications that have stimulant effects. It's been found that 20% of that medication is diverted illicitly, either the adolescent, you know, not taking it or overusing it or even selling the medication. The anxiety medications, most of them are habit-forming. So, I mean, I'm not giving these examples to say not to medicate when you have a co-occurring disorder, but just to say, you know, how one disorder can trigger the other when you're trying to treat one. And it's also important to be aware that the opposite can be true. If you're not properly medicating a mental health issue, then that substance abstinence can be sabotaged as well.
You know, Sarah, then what are the options to monitor someone, you know, as an adult with medication? That has been so frustrating to me with my son because of the misuse of his medications or taking too much or anything, and it's been very frustrating. Is there anything we can do, some options to monitor someone who's an adult and taking medication?
That is complicated because of, I know you don't want to mention HIPAA. You don't want to hear that word.
No, don't make me scream.
But I guess because you know that and we're informing other people, it, you know, have a, you know, sign a release form. You try to get that signed from the beginning and so that you can stay in contact both ways, the professional. But let me just say that even if you do not have a release form, there's no reason why a family member or loved one cannot call the professional to provide information. Even if the professional is just listening and taking in that information, again, that can help guide the treatment. And it's very important if you're seeing things of not taking medication or, you know, abusing the medication or missing medication or any positive or negative signs that you're seeing, to call in and share it, regardless of whether you're going to get information back from that professional.
Right. Those are important things to know.
Good. Okay, another thing that I think we want to talk about is the it's very, very important. I think we've definitely covered it, but let me say it again, that there are better treatment outcomes again and again when family and parents are involved. It is widely known from, you know, from the beginning that this is a family problem. The family needs treatment to recover together. This is not a situation where you could just drop off the person who has this problem and walk away and hope that you'll pick them up a certain time later and everything's going to be better. Time and again, we see in working with families and adolescents that the most successful person is going to be the person that has support from a family member. And when we're talking about adolescents, adolescents need adolescent-specific treatment. It can be very damaging to put a young person into an adult program. They're going to get information there that it will just further exacerbate their problems, give them ideas that they didn't have before. Can make things very glorifying and sound even better than what they were doing. And really, they're not going to relate. And if they're not going to relate to the issue, then they're not going to feel that they could even identify themselves as having a problem. They're going to feel like they're not there yet and they can go on for longer. So that's very important. And also, again, with studies, long-term treatment has the best results. The longer someone is in treatment, the better outcome that they're going to have. study after study has proven this, even though it lately short-term is more accessible and more talked about, either for reasonings of less and less adolescent beds are available, or they don't have coverage by state or insurance payments, or there's funding issues there. But definitely, if you can find long-term treatment, again, you're going to get better long-term outcomes. And speaking of that, recovery is an ongoing process. Supports do need to continue. Again, it's not a, you know, pick up from the recovery center and everything's been cured. Sharon, as we're kind of wrapping up the treatment part, are there any other, you know, issues or frustrations that you want to share that you've had along the process of your long process of, you know, having family members in treatment?
Oh, I think, Sarah, one of the biggest things, and this has literally taken me years and years to get to, is to accept, you know, for me to accept that my son has mental health and substance abuse issues, and to accept the fact that this is a long-term process, as you said, you know, there's no long-term cure here. Manage it. You can manage it. But it's very difficult. And so for me to realize that and accept that and accept the fact that, you know, this was his responsibility and his care, I can do what I want to, or I'm able to, I should say, to help him. But when it comes down to it, as in this case now, he's an adult. But for those who are coming behind me that are experiencing this, boy, I'll tell you, I could have used some ongoing support through all this. So one of the questions I'd want to ask, Sarah, is, you know, what do we as family members, as parents, need to ask providers when we're seeking help? What are the questions we need to ask?
Okay, good. I'm glad because I know you mentioned this before. Lots of questions that you could and should be asking from the beginning. Just even the basics of what we've already given to you from above, like what is your assessment process? And we talked about, you know, is it a screen or is it a full comprehensive evaluation that you're doing here at your agency? Asking if you specifically assess for substance abuse disorders and mental health issues. Asking if they do treat both. If so, how? If not, where can you refer me to? Professionals are required ethically to either offer help at that agency or to help you find the appropriate referral, not to just send you out the door. And then you can definitely ask what type of therapy is given for the person and what type of family supports and treatment is offered. Also important to ask is, what is your role as a loved one or family member in this process? What is your responsibilities here? What can you do to help your child? Those are all like really important questions, and I'm sure that there's more. And if there's anything that comes to your mind while you're sitting there in your interview or the beginning of your assessment process, just don't hold back, again, with any thoughts or questions that you are having. Even though I know in the beginning it's a very difficult, intimidating beginning. Yes,
yeah.
It's very intimidating. It's scary. It's scary to be sitting there. It's shocking in some ways. We see many parents here that just come in shock and really torn down by the process that they've already been living with someone who has an active addiction and at times a co-occurring disorder. So I know, and we recognize that as professionals, and we should recognize that as professionals, to be sensitive when we're having someone sitting there and give them time to come up with the questions and, you know, share your concerns as well with us. Just to summarize what we've talked about with treatment, we've talked about different types of treatment available, different modifications that are necessary when you're treating someone with a co-occurring disorder. We talked about different management of medication concerns. We talked about the importance of long-term adolescent-specific treatment, the family treatment that is so critical, and how ongoing recovery support is critical for the successful treatment of a co-occurring disorder. Some resources that we want to offer here at the end for your continued use, and if you wanted to continue to research and get more information about this, drugfree.org has a toll-free helpline for parents that's very helpful. That's 1-855-DRUG-FREE. SAMHSA.gov has a treatment locator. I do want to mention that substance abuse disorders and mental health providers are listed separately on their website. So if you find something that you feel would be appropriate or is in your area, call them first and make sure that they're able to treat and assess for a co-occurring disorder. I work, as was said before, at Dynamic Youth Community. Please feel free to call here myself for any further questions about this. or for help for yourself or a loved one or referral if necessary at 718-376-7923. You can certainly look at our website at dycinc.org. If you live in New York, the New York State Office of Alcohol and Substance Abuse Services website also has a provider search. Reading materials, two things I found really helpful, the Treating Co-Occurring Disorders by Hendrickson, Schmall, and Eckleberry, 2004 Hawthorne Haworth Press, and like I've mentioned before, the DSM-4 TR for professional diagnosis. Sharon also has a website that has a lot of advocacy and research and information on it. That's momstell.com. Sharon, would you like to talk about that or anything else?
Yeah, there is a lot of resources on the website, and you can get there at, as she said, momstell.com, momstell.org. Either one will get you there, and you can refer parents that maybe need a place to start. I also want to just quickly mention, and then I know we're done, the helpline that Sarah mentioned from drugfree.org. It's staffed by a social worker with practical experience in substance abuse prevention and treatment, and I must say I've availed myself of this service several times within the past year, and having someone there to help me deal with some of my family situations, sometimes just need an outside person outside the family dynamics to listen and share some proactive ideas on how to cope and offer hope and really just make it so you realize you're not alone.
Absolutely. Well, Karen, Sharon, I can't thank you enough for your candid sharing and, the touching story that you shared. Thank you so much all for listening. And I think at this point we'll turn it back over to Nicole for a poll.
Thank you. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Please tell us the degree to which you agree or disagree with the following statements. After I finish reading the entire question and all the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key, followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. The first question is, this session provided me with the information on diagnosing and treating co-occurring mental health and substance abuse disorders. Please press star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 for agree, star 3 disagree, star 4 strongly disagree. And we'll pause for just a moment to assemble the responses. We'll pause for just one more moment. Second question. This session educated me on treatments for co-occurring mental health and substance abuse disorders. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. And we'll pause for a moment to assemble the responses. One more moment, please. Next question. Overall, this session met my expectations. Please select one of the following. Star 1 for strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. And we'll pause for another moment. One more moment. Next question. I would recommend this program to others. Star 1 for agree. Star 2, do not agree. We'll pause for another moment. And our final question, please select the response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with substance abuse issues. Star 1, I am the parent of a child with substance abuse issues. Star 2, I am family of a member of someone with substance abuse issues. Star 3, other. And we'll pause for another moment. One more moment, please. Thank you, everyone, for your feedback and for participating in our program. If you would like to make any additional comments to help us improve this program or have any questions on today's topic, please press star 1 to have your phone line opened into the conference. Once again, that is star 1 for any additional comments or questions. We'll pause for a moment to see if we have any questions. As a reminder, that is star 1 for any questions, and we will take our first question. Caller, your line is open.
Is there a way to get a recording of the whole conference?
Yes, the recording will be available probably within the next day or so on our website, on that signabehavioral.com website, the same place where you'd find the PowerPoint.
Thank you.
And we will take our next question. Caller, your line is open.
Okay, yeah, I'm calling. My name is Kim, and I have a son who has, what I would consider co-occurring disorders. He's now 23. He's still living at home with me. I'm just wondering, I live in Minnesota, if you know of any resources I could tap into for him to get him some help. I did initially try going through the Hazelden organization, but they referred me away from them because they deal more with, the substance abuse, and felt that his needs were more the mental health piece, or at least stronger on that end than the other. And so I'm just really at a loss as to what I can do to get him some help.
Okay. Have you tried a provider search either through the SAMHSA website, which is the national website, or through your insurance provider?
Well, he's not under my insurance anymore, and the list with him is so long. I mean, he's unemployed. I just don't even know where to start, if I should start with the county, what I can even do now, because he'll be 24 in May, and I don't know what my options are at this point, since he's not a minor.
Right. Does he recognize that he has problems as well?
Yeah, he does. I've had him, when he was younger, had him go through, with all the channels, trying to get him on medications. When he was young, he had kind of the diagnosis of the ADD and was on some meds for that for a while. And then as he got older, it was more of depression issues and things like that. And, I had him to different therapists, and he was on medications and stuff too, but then he would just be very noncompliant. He would, not take the meds. He would not cooperate with the therapist. I mean, I think now maybe it might be a little different that he's a little older, but he's just going nowhere. I just would like to help him, get his life going somewhere.
Right. I think that's hopeful that you have that, you have a history there, and that he, is a little bit older and more aware of the problems that he's facing.
Mm-hmm.
I think it just to start somewhere. Did Hazelden give you any referral to somebody else?
Yeah, they referred me to the Fairview system, which I did contact. I actually was mailed out a packet, and my son filled out most of it, and then I had to fill out part of it, and I mailed it in, and I never, and this was months ago, and I have mm-hmm. never heard anything back on that. I wasn't sure why that was. I did try calling once, but I got transferred to, like, the wrong department, and then I never, I guess I didn't follow up with that. Maybe I should have followed up more with that, but I just wasn't, I guess, really thrilled with the fact that it took them so long to even, you know, acknowledge, did they get the paperwork, didn't they, you know. I know I was told that there was one physician that was treating, and it was more, it was in a kind of pediatric setting, and I didn't know that that was even really appropriate, but they said, well, that's how they, he was the one who kind of treated everyone, so I kind of got the impression that the list was long.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, this was like late summer, like July or something, and I said, well, when can I expect, you know, him to be evaluated? And they said at that point it was like January.
Kim, I don't know if you've gotten any help for yourself in all of this, but you're more than welcome, and encourage you to at least get on the Moms Tell website and contact me. I have a couple mothers that are advocates in your state that may be able to help offer some other options as well.
Oh, that would be great. And it's mom.
And maybe someone for you to talk to so you feel like you're not alone.
Oh, yes, that would be good.
Okay,
yeah.
Great.
Moms Tell, is it all one word?
Mm-hmm. One word.
Moms
just
tell.
Like it spells, momstell.org.
Okay. Okay, great. That would be, yeah, that would be
great.
That's great,
Sharon. Thanks. And I would definitely suggest to follow up with that organization, call them again and see if anything. I know that it's frustrating,
mm-hmm.
that sometimes the process can be long and the paperwork bogs down our initial
right.
you know, process, but don't give up, you know, keep calling. And if you need help, I'm not in that area, and this agency is in New York specific, but
okay.
we definitely will try to help you find some. If you want to call me as well, you
okay.
know, at Dynamic Youth, we could definitely try to search for you and find something that might be more appropriate for you and your son as well.
Yeah, that would be great. And I think I scribbled your number down. Is it 718-376-7923?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And what was your name?
My name is Sarah.
Sarah, okay. Yeah, that would be excellent.
Thanks so much for calling. We look forward to hearing from you.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Kim.
And as a final reminder, ladies and gentlemen, that is star one for any questions. We'll take our next question. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Kathy calling from Pittsburgh. I do appreciate very much everything that was said during this. I found it to be very educational. I did want to remind some of the mothers when it comes to this. I know in the Pittsburgh area we do have a dual diagnosis treatment program that is sponsored as some of the clubs that sponsor AA, NA meetings and things like that. They do help individuals that are such, you know, dealing with like bipolar disorders, which are very common.
Mm-hmm.
You can probably look into that more on a website. I'm sure there is a dual diagnosis and recovery available on there, but they are specific for patients, you know, that struggle with both aspects of it. The people that I have known that have suffered from dual diagnosis that have been successful in recovery programs are usually those that are very deeply involved in a 12-step recovery program with the support that comes along with that, plus being managed with a good medical input as far as their other disorder. Unfortunately, many times, as with bipolar customers or patients, they feel better when they get into a 12-step program and then they stop taking their medications. Usually everything comes crashing down around them. So the 12-step program, whether it be through AA, NA, or any other affiliated program, is an excellent support system because they will encounter people on their own level. I know the families mean well. Al-Anon is out there as well to support, because there's a lot of not only the denial aspect, but the grief of losing the child that you once had. Also, you know, it's a process of acceptance, you know, accepting where they are. And I always like to throw the Signet in there. It's like you meet them where they are and you help them get to where they need to be. You know, that's basically recovery in a nutshell right there. So a lot of it is, you know, allowing for the support systems, trying to get healthier people in their lives, you know, helping them to step away from the person's places. people, places, and things that foster that behavior. Clinical has its place in that, most definitely. Their medications need to be very closely monitored, but they need that engagement with a 12-step program that really, really should be enforced in order to save their lives. So, but that's all I have.
Thank you so much for providing that specific information for the Pittsburgharians. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Absolutely.
There appears to be no further questions at this time, so I'll turn the call back over to our speakers for any additional or closing remarks.
No, again, I just want to thank everyone for listening and taking their time out of lunch and listening to the information that we had for you. And, again, Sharon, thank you so much, and our best luck and wishes for you and your continued, you know, struggle with finding the right treatment for this disorder.
Well, thank you so much. And anybody out there, any parents out there, don't be afraid to ask the hard questions, and don't be afraid to get involved and reach out, because you're not alone.
Thank you. Well, with that, we will conclude today's call. Thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect.